This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Hamilton County Commission President Todd Portune has a plan to fund the repair and eventual replacement of the crumbling Western Hills Viaduct. And the county becomes part of a program to measure the impact of Narcan on the heroin epidemic. Joining us to discuss these and other local news are Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter Sharon Coolidge and WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Sharon and Bill, thank you both for being here this afternoon.
Happy to be here on this rainy fall afternoon.
Oops, it does feel
summer,
like fall.
Sorry.
Still technically summer.
It's hard to believe it's still summer, but rainy, cold day. Sharon, it looks like there's finally a plan in place to pay for replacing the Western Hills Viaduct, but the city and the county have been talking about this for, what, 8 or 9 years now about doing this? What's been the holdup?
Well, there's finally a plan being discussed, like as a way to pay for it, because it's far from a done deal. But, I mean, this conversation has been going on for years, and I think very seriously for at least 5 years. But it always stops short at that, we need a lot of money. Where are we going to get it? I don't know. No one has known. And so Todd Portune, you know, the new Board of Commissioners president in his new role with the Democrats taking over, he's floating a plan. And so this is the first time we've heard some very serious momentum behind this.
Yeah. What kind of shape is the viaduct in, Bill?
Poor. Structurally obsolete, structurally insufficient. It's falling apart. I mean, just a couple months ago, there were pieces of concrete falling from the Western Hills Viaduct onto vehicles down below. They're talking about putting up some safety netting to keep that from happening until they can replace it.
So how many incidents have we had here? And we're pieces of concrete have fallen off and hit a car.
According to city records, there's 6 official incidents. But after the story ran, I did get emails from people being like, my car was hit with concrete. Honestly, I'm surprised something more serious hasn't happened.
Yeah, I think that it's very fortunate that nobody's been injured or killed by this. Yeah. So how important is this viaduct to local commerce?
They say 55,000 cars drive across it every day, and it's long been known as the gateway to the West Side. I mean, if you're on the West Side and you're coming downtown or vice versa, you need to use this.
So the bridge is 84 years old. You're talking about the money is always the big challenge to getting anything done on it. What kind of price tag are they talking about? How much do they think it's going to cost to replace this thing?
The current price tag estimate is $355 million. And that just keeps going up. As Todd Portune pointed out Monday, it's up another $78 million just from inflation from the last time they took a hard, long look at this.
Officials swear to me, this is it. It's not going up. It's
$355 million, though.
I have $335, but still, that's a lot of money.
I'm sorry. Yes, yeah. $335.
That's still a lot of money. Sorry. But they swear, they're like, this is like the estimate now. Like, if we can get this done, then there won't be any more added cost to it. Because, I mean, it's climbed significantly in the last 2 years.
And right now they're paying to maintain it, right? How much does that cost?
$1 million a year. And even then, it's tough to, like, really take care of this concrete because they have to get up and assess it twice a year. They have to do extra. This bridge is in such bad condition, they do extra inspections. They literally get up there with a hammer, tap on it to see how things are going. And, you know, if it doesn't seem that great, they chip it away more. That's the solution. And so it's not really a solution.
And haven't they replaced some of the steel beams in the structure as well?
The last major rehabilitation was 40 years ago. And
wow.
That was the only major rehabilitation, too. So it's nearing the end of its usefulness.
But that's the thing. Those steel beams were a very big deal because this bridge is structurally sound. You're like, oh, it's so dangerous. It's in poor condition. But it's not going to crumble beneath your car because of these steel beams and this big fix. The problem is on the lower deck of what's going on the upper deck. So it's not safe to drive on from the standpoint of the under the road itself. It's from this falling concrete.
Yeah. So Bill mentioned putting nets in to catch debris. I mean, do they have any other plans or any definite plans to protect people in the meantime until something can be done about this?
That's pretty much it. That's all I've heard anyway.
Yeah.
No, the netting seems to be the solution. And honestly, they can't even net the whole thing. There's a price tag of $1 million if you wanted to kind of net over to catch the concrete. But they can't do that because then they won't be able to inspect it. Because then you'd have to take the netting down. That's just absolutely impossible. So they're just the worst places. They're talking about putting the netting just to be safe.
Now, are the plans to actually replace the entire structure or just renovate it to some point? Or do we know if it'll be in the same place or any of those details, Bill?
The plan is to build a replacement, and the preferred choice they're looking at right now is just to the south of where the current structure is. And since it spans over the rail yard there, that's adding a lot of complications. They'll also have to worry about the new lick run conveyance on the west side. They'll have to build around that with new on-ramps. Also, they've got to worry about what's going to be happening with I-75 in the next few years. They got to worry about the off-ramps there, connect it to Spring Grove. So it's a very complicated project.
Yeah, and I imagine if they shut it down there to replace it, they're going to have to be concerned about the impact that's going to have on local traffic, local commuters, and that sort of thing.
Well, that's why they cannot do that. Like, that's not even being discussed. The one thing I think about this project, even though it does have this, you know, huge price tag, it is already really thought out. It's thought out into what's going to be needed in several years and how to make it better and connect to everything. And so it's not just the same bridge that's getting replaced. It's a better bridge.
So what is Todd Portoon's plan? What is he proposing for paying for this?
Well, that sales tax we're paying now for the reconstruction of Union Terminal, when that expires, the county would ask voters to approve another sales tax replace that, and then that would be dedicated to infrastructure projects all around the county. Half of the money raised from that would go just for the Western Hills Viaduct. The other half would go for other projects.
So money from the sales tax is paying for the Union Terminal renovation right now.
Yes.
Are there any other elements to it?
Also, of course, that's just providing the matching funds for federal grants, for state grants. We'd have to, Hamilton County and Cincinnati would have to come up with, was it 80%? Or 20% matching grants, and then the feds and ODOT hopefully will provide that other 80% of the $335 million.
But so that's not anytime soon, because the tax doesn't expire until 2019. To get us started, they're talking about using something called the permissive auto fee, which would be a fee added on when you get your license plates in Hamilton County. And then that money would go towards this project and maybe some other projects too. That's something the commissioners have to decide on, though, and it can be up to 5%. The governor allowed it in this year's budget, in the state budget, for counties to do this. And so this is the first time I've heard anything talked about for that. So that's going to be a big discussion, I think.
But this is not definite yet. His plan is not definite yet. So what's next? Does this have to be approved by the rest of the commission, or how's that work, Sharon?
Well, the county is actually having a huge public hearing about all the projects we need. I want to say it's September 18th. Do not hold me to that date. But I think that's a big deal, because there's so many needs right now. A soccer stadium, the arena, the convention center, this bridge, to talk about how everything is going to get funded and if they're going to get done. And so the public's going to really have a chance to weigh in on that in September.
Now, Bill, you mentioned the Union Terminal renovation that's going on. You actually got a chance to take a tour earlier this week where they showed how far along they are and what they've been doing. What kind of progress have they made?
Periodically, they do bring the press through to say, here's what we've done so far. Here's what we're going to be doing. This is why we're doing this. And it's pretty interesting stuff. They've been able to, you know, the big dome that is kind of the mainstay of the Union Terminal. Well, they've rebuilt the wall, the exterior wall, completely. They took it down and then they rebuilt it up because so much water was coming through. They've taken out the fountain and the plaza out front, which has caused some temporary problems. But
are they going to replace the fountain?
Oh, yeah, the fountain will be rebuilt. All of that's going to be redone. But right now, because there's no concrete up there, when it's raining, like today, you're getting water dripping down into the exhibit areas, which are also closed off. And one of the things they were showing us yesterday, they've got this nice big tent inside underneath where the plaza would be. And inside that tent is going to be the new home of the Duke Energy holiday trains. It's going to be the permanent home. It's going to be on display all the time, not just during Christmas. And it's, 70 years old? And so they really don't like to move it around.
At least 70 years old.
Yeah. Got it in place now, and it's under a tent that's climate controlled just to kind of keep it intact.
What's going to happen to the original doors? Do we know if those are going to be replaced or kept?
I believe those will be kept. They're going to keep as much as they can. A lot of the little details, there's things that are being replaced, like a copper trim up on the parapets, some of the clay. Oh, I can't think of the name, but a lot of the masonry has been replaced. If it's antique and it's usable, they're going to try to keep it as much as possible.
Has the museum center gotten any reaction from patrons yet? Anybody who's noticed what's going on or looked at what's going on and said, hey, I like this or I don't like this, or have they gotten any kind of comments?
I saw something on Facebook just today, a matter of fact, from someone who said, I went to the museum center to see one of the exhibits that is still open. I mean, they've got the Shakespeare folios, they've got the Star Wars exhibit, they've got the Children's Museum is still kind of open. The woods are closed right now. The cave is closed. But this person on Facebook was like, oh, I was just so disappointed. I didn't realize that all of this was going to be on. It just looks horrible. It looks terrible. But they're doing the best they can. I mean, trying to keep the thing open and trying to, you know, let people still get in to see some of these special exhibits, you really can't expect there's not going to be some temporary changes. Yeah, they are going to be cleaning the murals.
A major renovation going on at this.
You can't see the murals on the inside of the dome right now because they've got kind of a temporary lobby built up, if you haven't been over there. And you walk in through the front doors, and it's completely different. It's like you're in a completely different space than what you're normally used to seeing.
Yeah, speaking of spaces, is this the idea to open up a lot of new space in the center?
Because they are updating all the HVAC and all the utilities, that's freeing up a lot of space. So down in the River City exhibit, they're going to be able to – you know, they've got those fake front buildings. Well, they're not going to be fake for much longer. You're going to be able to walk into those artificial stores and see more exhibits.
There has been a real commitment to the history with this renovation, but there is no doubt that it was needed. And the fact that a sales tax actually got passed for it, I mean, that speaks volumes. This building was in very bad condition. It was, you know, we were getting to the point where do we want to have it anymore? And the answer was yes. And this is what we have to go through to make sure that that happens.
They are 40% done, they tell me, and everything should be reopened and good as new in November of 2018. So it's going to be a while, but they are making progress.
And we'll continue our review of local news. You can join us, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, along with Cincinnati Enquirer investigative reporter Sharon Coolidge, WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhart, and WVXU reporter and midday local host, Ann Thompson. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, Sharon, the commissioners this week, they actually increased the senior levy that's on the ballot for this November, and the increase was 37% on this. I think the Tax Levy Review Committee had recommended keeping it level, but the commission said, nope, we're going to increase it. What was their thinking?
Well, honestly, that was a huge surprise, because traditionally when we're talking about what people are paying for levies, I mean, we had a Republican-controlled commission. There was talk of cutting how much the levies would get to save taxpayers' money. And those things really a little bit, but didn't really come to fruition. We've been paying the same basically for our levies for a while. But, you know, we've had a huge shift with Todd Portoon and Denise now controlling the commission. And they stepped up and they showed a real commitment to seniors in this county. And they did increase the senior services levy with a vote that's going to be put to voters in November.
And I think Commissioner Portoon also added in three new programs that are covered under the levy.
He did. That's not really the significant portion of it. That's $1.65 million for these programs. This is going to help a significantly more number of seniors. The number of seniors is increasing 6% every year in the county. And it's at a crisis level of they're trying to keep people in their homes. That's what this money is used for. And they just needed more help. So there's not waiting lists, and we can, I mean, there's a story about when they were talking about what they were going to do. They had people come in, and everyone who served by Meals on Wheels wrote what that program means to them on paper plates, and they were held up. There's like standing room only in the commission chambers to talk about this. And I mean, that was like, I've seen pictures and such a visual of what this program means to people. And so, you know, they made a commitment to it. It's increasing 37%. We pay now $29.40 per 100,000. And when it passes, if it passes, it's going to go up to $40.25 per 100,000.
Now, this has always had good support, though. I mean, it's been in existence for 25 years. Every time it comes up for renewal, it gets passed. I think last time it got 75% yes.
Everyone has seniors in their life. I think when you're going and you're maybe checking the ballot, you're thinking about yourself later or the people that you know. I mean, this money goes to good things. There's assessments of how it's been spent, and no one has found any problems with it. I mean, this money goes to what it's, people say it needs to go to.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And let's talk to Dave. Dave wants to go back to the viaduct for a moment here. Dave, go right ahead.
Yeah, so going back to the discussion about the bridge, I've been commuting on this 71-74 corridor construction zone for 4 years now, but the discussion keeps going to the bridge that's falling down. But shouldn't we be talking more of a regional infrastructure transportation scheme? We don't have enough buses. Buses are historically late. And there's not enough routes. There's no mass transit or rapid transit to the airport. We're a mess.
Yeah, and isn't Todd Fortune, isn't that one of his big issues? Is a regional transportation plan of some type?
Yes, he's wanted that for a very long time, and we've got the Hamilton County Transportation Improvement District, but that's just one piece of the puzzle. He wants to get Northern Kentucky involved in it, Butler County, Southeast Indiana, Claremont County. He wants everyone to, you know, get behind this so we can do these large-scale projects like replacing the Brent Spence Bridge, like putting a light rail between downtown and CVG. And so far, I've not heard a whole lot of support from some of these other places. Everyone seems to kind of want their own little piece of territory, and no one's really cheering for a major cooperation except for Todd.
Well, this is a long-term plan. He has talked about it for a long time, but, you know, he's in a position now to get done what he would like to get done. Even he says, he talks about 2020, which I guess is not that far away, but like he understands that it's going to take time. You have to reach out. It's my understanding the county's going to bring on an employee to be, well, not really like a consultant, to kind of start that ball rolling and reach out to these places. He is very serious about doing this. The kind of money that's needed, really regional cooperation is where that kind of money would come from. But it's hard to see if people will step up.
Yeah, the money seems to be the hold up on a lot of things.
And I think kind of one of the ideas behind having a regional cooperation is you have a little more clout with Washington, with Columbus, with Frankfurt, with Indianapolis. You'd be able to say, look, we are putting our side of this deal together. We just need a little more help from you, because they say Washington will hand out money if the project is shovel ready. If things are looking good locally, you're more likely to get those federal and state funds.
Well, and if we're talking about buses too, the job centers are all in downtown Cincinnati. They're all over the place. And that's what we need buses for, to get people to work. And so regionalism comes in there too.
Bill, Hamilton County Commission had some news about Narcan this week, and tell us about what's happening there.
Well, it was originally advertised as a donation, but it's not a donation. It is a study, a grant.
A grant, okay.
Worth about $2 million. Hamilton County will get $2 million from the maker of Narcan, and that will buy about 25,000 to 35,000 doses of this anti-overdose drug, this drug that firefighters, first responders give to people who've OD'd on heroin or other opiates. And what's going to happen is Hamilton County Health Department's going to collect all the data over the next couple of years about Narcan usage, about overdoses, about fatal overdoses and non-fatal. And their hope is they'll take all that data and be able to build some anti-opioid addiction programs that can work not just here, but elsewhere in the country.
Now, does this include training as well, Bill?
Some of the training, I think, is going to be paid for. UC is College of Medicine is going to be crunching a lot of the numbers. So it's kind of a partnership between Hamilton County Health, all the first responders, and the manufacturer of Narcan.
So when's this start?
This is going to be starting very soon. That $2 million worth of Narcan is going to be distributed over the next couple of years.
And if I understand correctly, this is part of a national initiative. Hamilton County is part of the pilot program.
The pilot project, yes. It's going to be happening here first.
Unfortunately, it's because we need it.
Right.
I just recently rode around with the fire department and the police department for another story, and to watch them, our public safety forces, administer Narcan and save someone's life is really, it's amazing to watch, because in one minute you're looking at someone who's dead and the next minute they're alive.
It's shocking to see. I mean, I've, you know, been out and about and just happened upon someone who was getting Narcan and he's laying down, the next millisecond he is bolt right upright.
I mean, I had somebody walk away. They were dead in 1 second, had it, and then they're like, they tried to give him help and he's like, no, I'm good. And he just walked away.
So the aim of this is just to inundate the community with Narcan.
They're going to flood the community with Narcan.
What kind of impact this has on the heroin epidemic.
Yes. Okay. That's it in a nutshell.
Sharon, I understand the editor of the Inquirer, Peter Badia, is taking on a new role later this month.
He is. I'm super sad. we learned yesterday, we're part of, the Inquirer is part of a big network of Gannett newspapers all over the country, and Peter is going to our Detroit paper to help them out.
The Detroit Free Press?
Yes, yeah, okay. They're very lucky. This was stunning news to the newsroom yesterday. We were very upset. We've had Peter for 2 years. He's made such a commitment to this community. He's been embraced by this community. We love him. But now Detroit gets to have him.
And any idea who's going to come in and replace him at this
point? Oh, we asked. I mean, they were telling this news to a room full of reporters. They said that it's a short search period. They did bring us Peter, so we're excited to see who comes next.
Detroit got our police chief. Now they're getting
the editor of the Inquirer of the newspaper. We've got Riverfest coming up on Sunday, and it draws 500,000 people to the banks of the Ohio River on the Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky sides. And you actually got to do something really fun this week. You got to take a peek at the Rosie's barge where they used for firing off the fireworks.
I was a little pushy. I had done this some years ago when temperatures were about 100 degrees, and they were miserable down there on their series of barges that they have hidden, as you mentioned, along the river. But I know with the rain coming, they were just extra busy, and so I kept pushing, I'll just, spend maybe 10 or 15 minutes down there. And they were very gracious, so I—
And this barge is in an undisclosed location. They don't want people knowing
where
this is at,
right? Yeah, I
won't
say where it is, okay. But you have to go down a dirt road. And I kind of thought, even though I'd been there, is this really it? I hope I don't get a flat tire.
It's in Sharonville, isn't it?
You're going to get her
very
in trouble.
Funny. Very funny, Bill.
Not true.
Yeah. Here they are. It's not as hot. This was yesterday. And they are on these barges that have, lots of sand. And they have a large portion of the shelves laid out. And they have tubes. And then you have Joe Rossi, who has multiple notebooks. And they're just very detailed about, exactly where they need to go, what angle they need to go in, and then how they're to be wired up so then they can be timed exactly with the music.
So what, you got a couple dozen of these notebooks? Is that—
There's actually 50 or more.
Wow.
Yeah. There's tons of them. And so they have, I think he said maybe there was a book for each site, and there were 20 sites on the barges, and then I can't remember how many sites on the two bridges.
Did he say whether they start planning it right after last year's, or is each one multi-year plans?
Yeah, so I think you're right. Just with the Findlay Market Parade, it happens right after it's over and they start planning this. And I did try to get out of him, all right, what's going to be new this year?
Would he
but
tell you
anything? He wouldn't tell me.
That's secret, just
like
the location.
You can expect the staples, the waterfall and the, off the bridge and the lanterns. And he said, yeah, look for some things that you have seen. But I learned something, Mark. I don't know if we have time now.
Oh, we got plenty.
Okay. All right. So, when you hear those just loud booms and you see the flashes, I always thought there was like a problem and maybe something didn't go off, but it turns out those are planned and they have a specific name.
Deliberate, okay.
Those are deliberate. And the purpose is they usually come right before something that they want you to pay attention to. So they time them out and you have these loud series of booms, and they're like echoing. He set off the buildings and they want to get your attention. And then he said, and that fires up the crowd, and then you'll look for something. And then they have, of course, a bunch of them right at the end for the finale. So then you know it's the end. But in one specific scene there, they were wiring this up. Then also, some years ago, some of the fireworks had computer chips in them. And they are not using any with computer chips. And I was kind of like, well, why? Why is that? And, well, they're just cost prohibitive now. And he said, okay, basically, these weren't his words, but it was kind of like, well, what's the difference? Like, okay, if it's 100 seconds, you know, it's still going to look good. It's still, but they don't use any computer chips. He says, as far as the technology, the fireworks are fireworks, but then obviously timing them to the show, you know, that's kind of advanced. But yeah, it's very detailed in all these books.
So what advice do you have if people are going down there? I mean, what should people do? Get there early, that kind of thing?
Well, yeah, I don't think that's changed. And, you know, it's on both sides of the river. Of course, they have the bands at Sawyer Point, and we have all this on our website. I'm sure the newspaper has it, too.
Cincinnati.com, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, uh-huh. And so, you know, on the other side of the river in northern Kentucky, they have a lot of events surrounded with, you know, and sponsored by restaurants. And, you know, I've watched it from both sides of the river. And, I mean, you know, there's any number of places that you can watch it. I was trying to think if there's any other information I want to pass along. You know, as far as, you know, what you can take in and whatever, that's all on the website. And we have information on metro and tank buses. And so, yeah, everything you would want to know.
And you can read Ann's story at WVXU.org. And as Sharon was saying, you can see all this information at Cincinnati.com, too. So, Sharon, Bill, and Ann, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Cincinnati Enquirer investigative reporter Sharon Coolidge, WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered Bill Reinhart, and WVXU reporter and midday local host Ann Thompson. Next up, Kentucky's pension for public workers is in for some huge changes. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. This week, an independent consultant recommended major changes to the pension systems that cover most of Kentucky's public workers. The controversy over Confederate memorials continues in the Commonwealth as African-American leaders call for the removal of a statue of Jefferson Davis from the Capitol. And joining us now to look at these stories and more, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Ryland Barton and political writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, Daniel DeRocher. We won't be able to take your calls during this part of the show, but you can still send your questions by email to talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Ryland and Daniel, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Howdy, Mark. Thanks for having us.
Dan, start us off and give us some background on this pension issue. Why are these changes being recommended? I mean, is the pension system in really, really bad shape in Kentucky?
Yeah, the pension system in Kentucky is actually one of the worst funded pension systems in the country. So there's this really big unfunded liability, which means that the legislature is going to be paying off or paying a lot of money to the pension system for a while. And so they're recommending these changes because something kind of needs to be done to fix this and to make it a little bit more manageable for the legislature. As it stands right now, John Chilton, who is the budget director for the state, he's calling for an additional $1 billion to be directed towards pensions in the next budget. And that's on top of the around $1.5 billion that the state already gives to pensions. So that means that $2.5 billion will be directed to it in the next budget. So lawmakers are trying to figure out a way to make it so that they don't have to pay as much money in the future. And so that's kind of the backdrop for these recommendations.
Ryland, how much of the Kentucky pension system, how much is it funded? What percentage is it funded?
Well, it depends on which account you're looking at.
Okay, so how many pension systems are we talking about here? How many different accounts are involved in this?
So so you have state government employees, you have local government employees, you have state police, you have teachers. And those are kind of the major ones. I mean, there's subcategories of state government employees and local government employees. But and they vary. I mean, none of them are very well funded, but it varies from around like 13-14% funded for the state government employees to around 59% funded for, I think, the teachers are around there. And none of that is good. You're not really doing well until you're at around 80% funded.
Yeah, you're not even talking. They're not even halfway there in a lot of cases. So, yeah, it sounds like not doing well at all. What is being recommended? What are the changes that are being recommended to the system to keep it afloat? Ryland?
So the recommendations are pretty drastic. They're saying that basically the only way to get rid of the current unfunded liability is to make changes to current retirees and current employees. That's the only way to kind of track that down. And so the biggest recommendation, the one that would be the most drastic, would be to take back the cost of living adjustments that the state gave retirees between 1996 and 2012. And so that would take a part of some people's paychecks back. And so that has retirees really up in arms because that would really affect their lives. There are some other recommendations that they made, like raising the retirement age for police officers and people who are in hazardous jobs from 55 to 60. And that really made them kind of nervous because the way I heard it from the spokesman for the FOP, he said that it's really difficult to be a 60-year-old police officer because of the physical nature of that job. And it would make changes to the retirement system for teachers as well. So it would take back their cost of living adjustments, and it would freeze. They still get around a 1%, 1.5% cost of living adjustment every year, and it would freeze that until the teacher retirement system was 90% funded. So they wouldn't continue to get more money as inflation goes up, and that kind of raised their ire as well.
How many workers are covered, Daniel, by the pension systems in Kentucky?
It's around 500,000, so around 14% of Kentuckians are directly affected by this.
So, Ryland, how likely are these changes to take effect? I mean, what has to happen for all this? Does this have to go through the legislature, or what are the steps to make the...
Everything's going to have to go through the legislature. It seems like the least controversial changes are making changes for people, future state employees, so future people who come into the pension system. It's likely that those, it seems like at least all the, Republican leaders who are going to kind of be in charge of these decisions in the legislature are, they're kind of for the idea of moving everybody onto a 401k type plan. So that reduces the state's burden. They're not going to have to be putting as much money into these pension funds and allow it to, allow these contributions to kind of accrue just through, 401ks that would then be getting their own employees' contributions and then and through investments on the stock market. The more controversial ones are these tweaks to current people in the pension systems. But again, that's what, as Daniel said, it's that's the way that the state's going to be able to immediately start saving money. And there's a lot of controversy and roiling among state employees right now, especially teachers. One other change that Daniel didn't mention is possibly changing a policy that state employees and teachers have been allowed to use, which is saving up their sick days until the end of their employment, and then it would it would more or less boost their salary at the end of their terms, and thus their pensions would be sweetened a bit for the rest of during their retirement. Teachers are saying this is kind of shifting goalposts on them after they've already been planning to not use these sick days during their careers, and then there's also raising retirement age and things like that for current beneficiaries. So that's where things start getting a little bit more controversial. The other big question with this is the state is going to need to devote a lot more money to the pension system no matter what. Originally, when we were talking about this special session for pensions. The governor was saying that it would happen along with tax reform, that the state would possibly be changing the state's tax code so that they could then get more revenue and put some of that revenue towards the pension systems. There needs to be more money going into this. Tax reform is off the table right now for this special session coming up, but it seems to be like kind of the elephant in the room for a lot of these things. Like, how's the state going to come up with more revenue to put towards the pension systems?
Ryland, what are the alternatives, though? I mean, as tough as all these changes sound, if these changes aren't implemented, what's the alternative to it?
Well, the big alternative is making cuts to state services. I think the number that was kicked around was something like a 16% across the board cut to most state services, including the state's education formula, which would be drastic. That would be huge, and really, that's kind of the apocalyptic scenario. If nothing happens to change the pension systems, then that's what the state's going to have to do. On the other side, like proposals for generating new revenue, right, lawmakers keep on kicking around the idea of expanded gambling. People estimate that could bring the state an extra like $400 million in tax revenue. Who knows if that's true? In other states that have expanded gambling, they've had very sunny projections of how much tax revenue that's going to bring in, and it hasn't worked out. And of course, the perennial legalizing medical marijuana and taxing it. That's kind of another one of these third rails in Kentucky politics that nobody really seems to want to touch, because Kentucky doesn't have a ballot measure. There's no way this could go to voters on election day. The legislature would have to pass something like that, and all of those legislators' names would be on a bill that would say that they've legalized medical marijuana. And a lot of people just aren't comfortable with a vote like that, or with that expanded gambling thing. It's similarly kind of a social issue. People think it's still kind of regarded as a vice in some circles when people start talking about expanded gambling.
Daniel, has there been talk of legal action over these proposed changes, or has any legal action been taken at this point?
So these are just kind of proposals at this point, so you can't really take legal action against them. But if the state were to take the recommendation to scale back the cost of living adjustments, then they could expect legal action. There are a couple of government retiree groups that have already kind of said, they've actually put out a call to any lawyers among them to say, hey, can you give us some advice on how we should proceed in the event that they do this? So that's actually one of the really big issues, is that in other states, when they've tried to change retiree benefits, making the changes that would impact the unfunded liability in the immediately, they've had to do court battles. So in Rhode Island, they were eventually able to come to a settlement in 2015 to have kind of a hybrid benefit 401k style plan. But in Illinois, they challenged it in the courts, and all of the changes that the legislature made were ruled unconstitutional. And so Illinois' pension problem keeps kind of ballooning, and they actually passed a tax increase this year to kind of address it. And it probably, the things that I read say that it still might not be enough to deal with the pension crisis as it is in Illinois.
Ryland, Governor Bevin held a live Facebook session to talk about the pension issue, and you wrote a story about how during the session he actually called out a Kentucky middle school teacher for an email she had sent him. What's the story on that?
Yeah, he started this Facebook live session with he put out a request to state employees to send in their ideas for how to fix the pension system, and a middle school teacher. She had sent a rude response to him with a cuss word in it. It was just a sentence long, saying, "Do not bleeping email me again." And Bevin just kind of started off this session calling her out and saying, "This isn't helpful," and called her out by name.
How's that helpful? He could have just ignored her just as easily.
Certainly, and I'm sure that there were probably lots of other rude replies that Bevin's received, not only in this forum but others. But this is kind of part of the governor's style. He really likes to he's he's really into talking about the message and how we communicate and really trying to control the way that people talk and trying to, you know, I think from his perspective, trying to make a more civil discourse. You know, it's a somewhat impossible task when you're trying to wrangle, you know, thousands and thousands of state employees. But anyway, she was upset and saying that the governor had threatened her. But there were other kind of flare ups in this Facebook Live video that teachers had taken issue with. And the governor is also, he's kind of lashed out at teachers or at least teachers groups several times throughout his administration. And in this particular case, he was, you know, he was addressing teachers who were thinking about, you know, somebody in this Facebook Live video had asked, you know, what will the state do if all these teachers retire, if you change their pension benefits, if they retire right now because they're afraid that they're going to lose certain benefits. And he had, you know, he had just kind of addressed that directly, saying those teachers who, you know, might walk out on their classrooms, it's not in the best interest of children, and they should just go ahead and retire. And said he's completely serious about it. But then he did also end it with, you know, of course, doesn't imagine that most teachers are wanting to do that or thinking that way about it.
Daniel, how confident are state officials they can come up with a solution that's going to satisfy everyone for fixing the state pension system?
I don't think that they're confident that they'll have a solution that will satisfy everyone. I think that they're confident that they'll come up with some solutions. But it's a really difficult task that they're facing. And no matter what, people are going to come out unhappy. It's a really difficult challenge. And Speaker Hoover is saying that he's going to need a lot of time to kind of develop this plan. Now that he got the recommendation, he was saying that it'll be a couple weeks until the legislature drafts their own version of a plan. And then the staffers will need to write that up 3 to 4 weeks. And then he wants to give all of his members at least 30 days to study it so that he knows that his members are knowledgeable about it and are comfortable with what they're voting on. And so that means that we won't really see kind of what they're proposing until November. And the special session, if it's called, will be in November. And that's kind of a long time for people who are kind of in a frenzy because of these recommendations to have to wait until they really see what's going to be a result of the process.
Ryland, there's a debate going on about the statue of Confederate President Jefferson Davis that's in the state capitol building. Fill us in on this, please.
Sure. This is an ongoing debate. This is an ongoing debate that's been going on for years. African-American groups and others have been pushing to remove this white marble statue of Jefferson Davis from the Capitol Rotunda. And it's heated up, especially in the wake of the Charlottesville, Virginia, violent protests from a few weeks back. And this week, black leaders and legislators called for its removal. This is something that the governor's gone back and forth on back during his governor's race in 2015. He actually called for the statue to be removed and put into the State History Museum. And it didn't happen at the time, even though then there are other politicians, Republicans and Democrats, who called for it to be removed as well, including Mitch McConnell and governor at the time, Steve Beshear. But it didn't get removed. The Historic Properties Commission, which is kind of in charge of what is in the rotunda, said that they're going to leave it there and promised to make these educational materials for tour guides to talk more about the context of Jefferson Davis and the Civil War. That still hasn't happened. So more leaders are calling for it to be removed again. The governor since said that removing Confederate monuments is a sanitization of history. So at the moment, it still remains there. He's also kind of deferred once again to that commission that's in charge of it, saying, oh, well, leaving it up to them to decide its fate. So far it's just been leaders rallying against it, and there hasn't been a lot of talk from officials who are actually in charge of it of moving it at all.
Daniel, people are discussing removing these statues, but Kentucky has an awful lot of buildings and streets and so forth that are named for Confederate figures. How much do you see this discussion growing over the next year?
In terms of, I think it's mostly kind of contained to statues right now. more than necessarily streets. Because there are sometimes you get a Lee Street and it's not necessarily named after Robert E. Lee. It could just be named after some other guy who was important to that city or town who had the last name of Lee because it was a common name. But it really has to do with kind of, from what I understand, the symbolism of these statues, how these statues were put into place. A lot of them came about during kind of the early 1900s when segregation was an issue and people were trying to kind of affirm segregation. And so the symbolism of honoring these Confederate generals is what I think is rubbing them the wrong way and honoring them in kind of statue form. I know we have a big debate over whether or not they should be moved from the courthouse area, and part of that debate is because the Lexington Courthouse was one of the largest slave markets in the South. And so a lot of people feel like to have statues honoring Confederate generals and
okay, I think we lost Daniel there. Ryland, how much do you see this discussion, this debate, growing in the next year?
I think it'll continue for the next while. I think that right now, as Daniel was talking about, Lexington's kind of in the middle of possibly removing these statues in the courthouse square there. Once that's happened, white nationalists have promised to hold a big rally, similar to what we saw in Charlottesville. So, it's really people can continue bringing these issues to the city, then or city or to the state, then there's still going to be a lot of talk about it, and state officials are going to be forced to address it. At least for now, the issue doesn't seem to be dying down. Although we saw the same thing, a couple of years ago, in the summer of 2015, that was in the wake of the massacre at the African American church in Charleston, South Carolina. There's a lot of consternation over these Confederate symbols, and after a month or two, the conversation kind of died down. So we'll see. It does certainly seem to be a little bit more intense this time around. And Louisville also going through a similar thing with the Confederate statues and parks there.
And Daniel, are you back with us?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Weird phone problems, I guess.
I think we did. Go ahead. I don't want to give you a chance to go ahead and finish your thought on this.
Where did you lose me?
lost in terms of how much you think this is going to grow, and then as the debate's going to grow over the next year. And where is all this headed next?
I think the debate's going to continue. I don't know. I know the president and people like Governor Bevin have kind of said, what will be next? Should you get room? I don't know. I don't think that I see an issue with the symbolism of these specific statues, the symbolism of the Confederate statues, the context place. And I think it'll continue being a discussion as these processes to remove them take time, and moving big statues is always difficult. It's difficult. So it'll continue to be in the public light. I don't see it getting that much bigger, but they say that prediction is the lowest form of journalism. So I don't know how likely I can be.
Okay. Thank you very much, Daniel and Ryland. Greatly appreciated having you on this afternoon.
Thanks a lot. Yeah,
thank you.
Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Ryland Barton and political writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, Daniel DeRocher.